Buongiorno. Buongiorno a tutte e tutti. Scusate il farone lì, posso star qui dalla regia. Allora iniziamo questa mattina.
So this morning we're going to begin with a session on anti-racism in a racist society. We are called upon not to be racist, but we must be anti-racist. There's a slight change in our program. We're going to bring forward Joe David's presentation to before the break, and then we're going to have the a session on in memory of Rosalba. I would like to thank Silvia Fontana, MSF Italy, responsible for human resources in Italy. She's going to be moderating this session. And linked with us, we have Andrew Pan, Senior Consultant at Africa Rios Partners. And then Kossi Komla Ebri, who's a writer and President of Redani. And Florence Omorojeva, an emergency humanitarian worker. And these are all linked with us via Zoom. Thank you to you all for your participation. Good morning to you all. I hope you have had a good night's rest after the first day of our forum. And as Monica was saying, we're going to be speaking about racism and anti-racism. The session is meant to be a moment of discussion with our panel members on the meaning of racism for each of us, especially in an increasingly complex society. And what is the meaning of taking anti-racist actions in a proactive manner and therefore become an agent of change? And our organization, Médecins Sans Frontières, and also in our society, in Italy, that is. For this reason, I wanted to make a brief introduction telling you what MSF is doing as a movement with regard to this important issue, and I'll be very concise. It's been about 2 or 3 years now that Doctors Without Borders has started reflecting on the issue. We started by looking at racism within our organization, which is we call systemic racism or institutional racism. And thanks to the desire to constantly improve and in a very concrete manner, Doctors Without Borders has set up projects and initiatives that I'm going to be mentioning, because with Annalisa, I'll be providing links so as to gain deeper understanding about these projects. And a concrete example is the establishment of a committee, an international project on anti-racism, aimed at creating a group of people, a cohort of people coming from the movement, that is capable of promoting these difficult discussions within all the sections, within all the OCs, on racist related issues within the organization. And then another working group that was set up is the ETI working group at the international level, and Equity, Diversity and Inclusion, EDI. This working group does not only deal with racism, but it also considers other issues linked to inclusion, diversity, and equity within our organizations. The aim of this working group is to create best practices amongst many realities within MSF and in the world, so as to increasingly become an inclusive organization. And to give you a direct understanding of this aspect of MSF, which is already working on anti-racism, I wanted to pass the floor to Erastus, who's with us today, and he's a member of the International Board and co-chair of the Committee on Anti-Racism of OCBA. So you have the floor. So he can give you his viewpoint. And then we'll pass the floor to our panel members. We'll be asking them two important questions.
So morning again. Erastus Chet is my name, member of the IB. But before I joined the IB, I've been part and parcel of the Agora Anti-Racism Committee, which is by extension OCBA, as an OC. And so OCBA has made an intentional action in terms of starting to deal with anti-racism discussions. So sometimes it's been work that has been going on for about 1.5 years now. Early this year, a statement was passed at Agora governance body, first of all acknowledging racism within OCBA, that it happened, it's still happening. And within that statement, there was an apology that was made in the statement to anyone who might have been affected, either directly or indirectly, and also to acknowledge that it's still happening, it needs to be tackled. Apart from that, there were specific calls in terms of what needs to happen and put in place in to start handling racism within OCBA. And very clear activities were streamlined and they were put down in terms of which activities are going to be implemented within OCBA, whether it is at the governance level or at the executive level, to address or to highlight racism issues. And so after that statement, we've been working, the Anti-Racism Committee has been working together with the GD for OCBA, together with the OC president, that is Paola, in terms of putting down and actually implementing the calls in the statement. So for a period of time, I think now about 6 or 8 months, we have come up with very clear activities that are going to be embedded both at the governance level and also at the executive level and management specifically on what is going to be implemented to ensure that as we discuss racism, it's not just a discussion, but it's more of an action-oriented conversation. So I'll just try to summarize because I have only very few minutes to do this. We'll continue having these conversations as the conversations proceed. After coming up with those activities, we spent about 3 or 4 months working on specific indicators that are going to track the implementation of the activities, both at the governance, both at the management level. So we have about 39 indicators that have been developed to track each and every activities with timelines, whether they are going to be tracked on quarterly basis, on annual basis, or yearly basis, or monthly basis. To ensure that, yes, we said these activities are going to be implemented, but are they being implemented? What are we seeing? Do we see change? We have indicators that are looking at the outcome, long outcome, in terms of what happens after 2 years, after 1 year, after 3 years. Do we see perception change? Do we see inclusion? When you look at the HR, do we see regional balance? Do we see people being given fair opportunities in terms of employment? And first of all, do we see that there is an acknowledgement that racism does exist? So those indicators have already been developed. We've been working hand in hand with the DEI lead of OCBA, the HR lead of OCBA, the president, the behavior committee, working closely together to ensure that there is a coordination. So it's not work that is only being done by the anti-racism committee, but done together with the entire, with everybody in OCBA. A few weeks ago, we had a workshop at Agora that was being facilitated by external people who came to give us a workshop on how do we define racism? When you talk about institutional racism, what is it? And when you look at racism, do you look at racism as yourself as an individual or as an institution? And how do we work together to tackle racism? And first of all, do you acknowledge that there is racism? So we had a very good workshop. I think, Monica, you missed it. You left early before it did happen. You were there with Monica. So it was, we had a workshop for specifically for the governance team, which is the Agora board members. And we also had a workshop with the management. So there was one day with the management, another day with Agora leadership. And through those conversations, definitions of what racism is, first of all, having a self-reflection as an individual. Do you think racism is a reality? Does it exist? Does it not exist? There were key discussions that were going on. We also had a brief conversation about brief space, because one of the key deliverables of the statement or the call of the statement is to come up with a brief space. And so brief space is where people can freely interact, share experiences without being victimized, whether it is staffs, whether it's from the association, to come and speak about their experiences, what they think about racism, how they have been affected, and so forth. So we're also thinking of coming up with a brief space, which will be happening on quarterly basis going forward. We had a bit of introduction on that. So maybe just to summarize, I know racism, it's a difficult topic to discuss, and we need to accept. It's a very difficult topic. But it needs all of us on the table. I can't do it alone. You can't do it alone. You need everybody to participate. But most importantly, you need to acknowledge that it exists. You might not be the one who is perpetuating racism. It might be the society. It might be the institution. It might be the department. And so it needs an all-inclusive process. First of all, acknowledging that it is there. And so OGBA is a very good example on how MSF can really pick up the discussion about racism and how to tackle racism in the movement. And it has shown a very good way of collaborating, both at the governance, because the governance has, first of all, to own the process. And you see, with OGBA, we started with Agora itself. Do you own that truly there is racism? And so it starts from the top leadership as you come down to the rest of the stakeholders that are involved. So it will be important that even as MSF Italy, you discuss racism. And the first impression when you start discussing racism, you go to the defense mechanism. No, I don't think it exists. And that is a hard question to answer. It's a hard thing to accept sometimes that it does exist. I've seen it even in many of our conversation at Agora Conversation. People openly say, no, I don't think there is racism in MSF. And so, which is not a bad feedback. That's how that person feels, and we need to appreciate and respect that. But you have to keep on the conversation. But let it not just be a conversation. Have specific actions that you need to put in place. Know how you are going to monitor them, to measure them, to see whether there is change that is happening. Let me stop there, and I think we're going to continue having that conversation as we move forward. Thanks.
Grazie mille. Grazie, grazie mille, Erastus, veramente. E proprio
So with this invitation to taking action and reflection, let us open the debate with our panel members, and we're going to begin with a question, and that is, this is addressed to each panelist, what is racism for you and what can you share with the audience about racism? Florence wanted to start, and perhaps each of you can give a brief presentation and tell us who you are and what you do.
Buongiorno a tutti. Mi sentite?
Molto bene.
Good morning. Can you hear me? First and foremost, I'd like to thank you for the invitation and for giving me the opportunity to be here and discuss with you, with the volunteers and most importantly with MSF staff. As I was saying to Silvia, MSF was my first love in the social and health field back in 2006 in the Campania region, in more specifically in Castelvolturno. So coming back to have conversations with you is always a pleasure for me. So my speech is not going to deal with social issues, and there are other people more that are experts on this topic, but I will just share with you my experience as a woman, a black woman, African woman who lives in Italy for more than 20 years. As Erasmus will say, racism is a difficult topic to discuss. It's a very subtle and embarrassing subject. Sometimes it is invisible or transparent because it is only perceived by the person that is affected by racism. I will share with you give you some example. So, and I will tell you how racism can be revealed through gestures or with syllables. You black people, you women who have to put up with many things. So I'm not referring to right or left parties, but I'm just saying that there are people that are against us, but there are people that have no intention whatsoever to address, to talk to us. But for these people, it is normal to have a different behavior when they talk to us, as opposed to what they do when they talk to white people. And this is racism. This is what we mean by racism. So, as I was saying, I will give you some examples, simple examples, because the body and the brain has a sort of defensive mechanism. So when nasty, unpleasant things happen, you tend to forget, either because it was a real trauma or because you just want to, you didn't like them and you want to forget them. But there are things that will be reminded by my husband, by my friends, by my family. So I was saying before, it takes only a little piece of a conversation or a syllable, a word, to make people racist. The sound ooh, the sound ooh, you, is a racist, aggressive behavior, because in Italy you don't use you to people if you don't know them. Often when you don't know people, you tend to be cautious and kind enough, and you tend to address them using madam or mister, etc. And so you have to use the third person, which is very difficult for foreigners to use the third person when talking to people you are not familiar with. So you tend to use you, tu, in Italian, only when you are part of the family, when you are talking to a child, or when you're talking to a friend, etc., when you are in a close friend. So you can't use you to someone who you meet for the first time, except few cases, except for these few cases, you have to use the third person in Italian. This is an example, but of course you are all too familiar with this. This was my intro. So the elderly, of course, used the third person. And they use the third person when they talk to the waiter, when they talk to the doctor, etc. This is the rule, right, that is applied in Italy. But this rule does not apply to black people, migrants, foreigners. So whenever you meet someone who you don't know, in spite of the age, you, if you address someone formally, you have to use the third person. I'm not suggesting that everyone is using the second person, the you, instead of the third person. There are a few exceptions, and there are people that talk to me and they address formally and say, Madam, but this is the exception to the rule. So this you issue has been raised repeatedly. Even Prime Minister Meloni, when addressing one of the members of the House, used the second person, the two, and that was highly criticized. Addressed in Can you hear me? Yes, yes. So this happened in the House of Parliament. The Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, addressed informally a member of Parliament using the second person, whilst she had been used the third person for all the others. So it is something that can be instinctively activated by some of cultural triggers that is inside us. And that's the way it is. This was my first example. The second example, and forgive me if I take a little bit of time. So when I'm queuing up at the supermarket, the cashier, of course, uses, of course, addresses me informally and says, you, and shows me that I have to wait. But at the same time, she was telling me that I had to keep far from my husband, who is white, and to wait for my turn, because in her mind, this mixed couple, the fact that a black woman is married to a white man is something strange, is something that is not accepted. When I'm in the waiting room of my doctor, I was waiting for my time, and at one point I heard the secretary whispering, and she was saying to other patients, don't worry, do not worry. This is all right. The husband is white. Don't worry. Her husband is white. She's not a problem. Her husband is white. Just to explain that because I was married to a white man, I had to be respected. Or, for example, another situation where as soon as I get on the bus, the woman that pulls the bag next to her waist, or, you know, all these instances are just example of a situation. Once, for example, I was in a supermarket. I was going to do some shopping on Sundays with all the family. But during the week, I was just passing by to buy a few items. And they were following me, just the way black people are followed normally because black people are seen as criminals. So on Wednesday or on Thursday, they will follow me. But when I was there with a family on Sunday, I was a respectful person, a respectful woman. It took them 2 years that was the same person. The same person that was going shopping with the family on Sundays was going shopping alone on Wednesday. Another example, someone who is touching my hair. This is stroking my hair. This is something that unacceptable. I mean, this is something you can do with dogs. While I'm in a commercial in a mall, if I see a dog, a beautiful dog, I can, after asking permission, I can stroke the dog. Well, this is happening, I don't know how many times, men, women, adolescents that try to stroke my hair. They would never dare stroking the hair of a white woman. I just remember once I was supposed to pick up the passport. I was sitting with a policeman just opposite, and another police agent, a woman, comes, and all of a sudden she puts her hands inside my hair, saying, "Oh, how beautiful, how soft." My look was highly perplexed. And she kept stroking. She was going on stroking, talking to her agents, colleagues, how nice, how beautiful, how soft, without paying any attention to my face. At that time, I was not there. I was non-existent. It's just like you stroke a dog. You don't pay attention to the feelings of the dog, and she was not paying attention to my feelings. Now, talking about animals, you can easily understand the reference I'm surreptitiously making to animals, bananas, the body, the wild body of a black woman. There are people say that I love black women. For some men, it is natural to touch women, black women. Once I read an interview. The person interviewed being a white man, and he was saying that he was going with black women because this was not cheating on her wife. He goes with the black women because he considers that going with the black women is not cheating on his wife. Whereas he conceived that cheating on her wife would have been going with white women. Another example. Oh, you speak beautiful Italian. This is a compliment, but also some shows a surprise because they do not expect a black person like me to speak good Italian. Well, of course, that is normal because I came to Italy when I was an adolescent, and that's fine. But when they use this expression, when they talk to my children or my niece, this is really unbearable. I mean, they were born here. They're Italian. My niece is 15, 14, and often she's asked how much you want, how much do you ask when she's waiting for the bus at the bus stop. How sad when she's looking for a job, she often they turn down the job because when she shows up, she has no accent. So when there is the telephone conversation, they don't realize that she is black. But then when she shows up, they realize that she's black and she's not longer offered a job. So this is another example. There are many Italian black people that must be accepted by Italians, and this is something that we are still struggling for, and there is a long way to go. And there are two levels, the legal level with the jus solis or jus coli, etc., but also the social level. I think that the political level must reflect the social level. The society must first and foremost accept new practices. The society I'm talking about is, for example, the school, the teacher. The teacher of one of my niece was often describing the example of my niece as a model. Say, look, even Joy can do this. Even Joy can say this. Even Joy knows this. If she can do it, everyone can do it. But Joy was born in Naples. She was brought up in Naples, and she's Italian, but they don't see the difference. Even the teacher, the high school teacher, doesn't perceive the difference. So what I'm trying to say is that there is a very dangerous form of racism that is perpetrated on a daily basis and is touching on each and everyone's life and causes damages that stay for a long time. So I'm not an expert, as I said at the outset. I'm not a scholar. But one thing is clear to me. All these examples are not a result of ignorance, as we often say. Well, it's ignorant. Leave me alone. Even white friends. I have friends among white people, of course, and they share these stories with me. There are comments that are posted on my Facebook profile. And they will say, my friend will say, don't pay attention, these people are ignorant. But there were lots of messages, racist messages posted on my account. Perhaps these people find their own identity posting those messages. Just once I was at the grocery, and while doing the sandwich, he was trying to explain that I will never be a true Italian person. That was really disgusting for me, and I felt like I didn't want to be Italian anymore. I was really angry, upset. I was upset outside and inside. I couldn't even eat the sandwich that I had bought. Those are the situations that I was struck by. In Castelvetrano, there is a basket team called Tam Tam. All the players were born in Italy. Of course, the parents are not Italians. And every year they participate in a championship, local championship, I suppose. But the regulations provides that there is at the most three non-Italian players. Whereas in that case, they are all non-Italian.
Grazie.
So thanks to the intervention by a politician, well, every year this town makes this discrimination, explaining that they're not Italian, as the baker did with me, because a true Italian, you can tell when someone is truly Italian. I am about to conclude. And as an English new Avalanche wrote in her book, I don't speak about racism anymore with white people. I have the English version of this book. And I, they continue to say to us and to our children that we're all the same, we're equal, but this is a lie. Even though it is, the intentions are good, but we're not all the same. Our society is based on injustice, and diversity is never a positive thing. It's diversity is full of discrimination, of stereotypes that are racist. And in the case of women, there's also misogyny, which is racialized. As I said earlier, I've been living in Italy for over 20 years now, and the things that have happened to me in the past continue to happen even today. And I started realizing, increasingly realizing, the meaning of certain phrases, of attitudes, of the body language, of glances. And the situation, I would say, has even worsened because of the propaganda, the xenophobic propaganda. However, I have started to notice some positive changes in the younger generations, those the children who grow up with our children. And I'm pleased to notice that in the fictions and Italian TV series, amongst the protagonists, there are also black actors and actresses having a protagonist role, a leading role. And I think that this is a sign of an improvement, of changes, of improvements. And also in the literature, in the Italian literature, some Italian writers are of black descent. Giaba, and there are several black writers also in Italy. So their books are being read. They were were black people born in Italy that had been invisible up to recently, because the only black people in Italy were the victims, those who arrived in Lampedusa, the people that would arrive in Italy on the boats. So there would be victims, and you would speak about victims and not about normal people. But what is most important is that thanks to these black authors, it's not only white people who speak about black people, but we are speaking about ourselves. Now, in what I've told you so far, I think you may have an idea of what black American women experience. We have a NATO base here. The wives of military men, of the Navy, U.S. Navy, and so on, when they or their children experience the things that I have just shared with you, well, this makes me think of a phrase by Shaba Shebo that I read a few months ago, and which said, and I'll read this, racism, which in Italy is not seen, for others, it's not only evident, but it's even obscene, even because of its unawareness, being unawares. And Italy is unaware of the evil it is doing and that it is imposing on black people. Another thing I would like to say is that besides being a black immigrant, well, years ago, we used to use bric-a-brac to find a job, and I called on the phone because there was no WhatsApp or internet at the time, and my surname seemed Russian, and the person on the other end of the phone thought that he or she was speaking with a white person. So I went to the appointment. There were two of us there for that interview, and they said, "Are you Florence Omorogieva?" Well, I wasn't given the job because of my skin, the color of my skin. A few years ago in Milan. Yes, I'll conclude. Thank you, thank you. I'm about to conclude. In Milan, a group of black women, they wrote a letter to the mayor, of the who was from the Democratic Party. In a journal, the mayor was there was a photograph of the mayor with a white boy sitting on him and a little black girl on the floor. And the subtitle was tolerant but paying attention to the rules. And so, and Milan has become a model to be imitated. Of course, this was done in good faith, but this is how they concluded the letter. And this is my conclusion as well. Namely, that you can pretend, you can make believe, and on the showing a little black girl sitting at the floor, at the feet of a man, of a white man, who looking straight into the straight ahead of him, smiling and saying that he has made a challenge that he himself has not understood yet. Thank you, Florence. I'm just going to say a few things in passing. Thank you. And at this point, I would like to ask the other two panelists, Cossi and Andrew, to share their thoughts, also picking up on what we have heard from Florence with regard to the concept of daily racism, the racism that deprives people of their dignity. And she has spoken about feeling, and I'll try to say your words. I wasn't there. I didn't exist. And with this, I'll leave it up to you now to speak. Okay, Cossi. Good morning to you all. Can you hear me? I would like to thank you, and I thank Florence for having introduced this issue with such telling examples and of how she has brought to light the psychological violence that we experience constantly. I have been in, I live in Italy since 74. Since I was 18, I eat spaghetti and I read Dante, Calvino, and I know the Italian literature. But in spite of all of these years, when I'm out in the street, I'm beckoned as a non-community person. And I have even saved people's lives. However, my aspect is what defines me. So I am a non-community member. And this means that I don't belong, that you don't belong to the European community, the Americans, non-community members, the Japanese, and non-community members. But if you go out into the streets and you stop someone, you ask them, who is a non-community member? They will never say an American or... this is how banal racism is. In fact, it's called atmospheric racism because when you think of when you speak of racism, you may think of violence and so on, but there is a daily racism which is sort of it's a creeping sort of racism. And there's a power predominance and privilege. These are three elements that, without which you can't understand. Now, those who have power, if I believe I have power over you, and this prevents you from breathing. And in daily life, in our everyday lives, I studied medicine in Bologna, and I'm a general surgeon. I have a specialization in general surgery. I wanted to be a gynecologist. When I was working in the ward, I was dissuaded from being a gynecologist. So the daily... You know, the everyday experience is based on choices that you're obliged to make. I specialized here. I did university, but I had to wait for 10 years before exercising my profession because I couldn't enroll with the Order of Physicians because I didn't have the right papers. A few days ago, I was... coming home from Bolzano, and I was in the Bologna station. On the platform, there were three policemen. They were on platform one. I was on platform three. They crossed the crossed the rails and asked me for my documents. There were lots of people there. I wasn't the only one there. I wasn't doing anybody any harm. But they are the law, and they asked me for my identity papers. They looked at my identity card. When they saw that I was a doctor, they addressed me formally. And they said, are you Italian? And I said, yes, I am. And they gave me back my identity card. And I said, can I ask you a couple of questions? And they said, oh, we're not racist. And I said, I'm not saying that you are, but I just wanted to ask you, do you... know that you're not allowed to cross the railway, the tracks. You're not allowed to cross the tracks as you did. So racism is a constant thing. When I get off the plane in Malpensa, I have to. They ask me to look inside my to check my bags, to check my suitcases. And on one occasion, I was really in a hurry because otherwise I would lose my connecting flight. And I said, "What do you?" They wanted to see my bag, and I said, "I'm in a hurry." I said, "Do you think that I have cocaine here?" So. This is what we experience daily. And this is what we experience personally. And we run into this sort of attitude when we're looking for a job, when we're out in the streets, when you're on a bus or whatever. And people will sit next to me only if there is no other seat available. For instance, our children often are not allowed to go into a disco. So it's not only an issue of you talking to you informally, but when you walk into an office, at times they sort of spell the words. They don't talk normally, thinking that you don't understand. Who would ever touch a doctor's hair? But this type of racism occurs also in the NGOs, in their campaigns, in raising funds, in, especially with names and surnames. They do horrendous things. These are things that we need to say. The photographs of the children, you see these children with their noses leaking and crying. There's no respect, no respect for their So you're supposed to have respect for white children, but not for black people, black children.
Even pictures can be can kill. So we really have to stop using the faces of people to offend people, and we have to talk to the brain of the people. We have to try to be on an equal footing, and this is the cause of so many phobias against African people, which is lays at the basis of racism. This is sense of superiority towards us. When I go to schools, I ask students, when I say Africa, what is the thought? Your first thought? People that are starving. This is the image that comes to mind. The first, after we say Africa, that's the only thought that they have. And this image is the result or the continuation of our thoughts. When you say the word Negro or black, you look at, you say a word and you have an image. If you say red, you close your eyes and you see the fire. So the imagine the what you imagine has to be positive. So if when you say a word, and you say a word in African language, but in Africa there are more than 200 languages, not dialects. And I'm asked, tell me a word in your African language. But how nonsense all this is. So those are the images of Africa. People that visit the African country, spend their time on the beach, and then come back to France, and they say, I know Africa. I know the continent, but this is nonsense. You don't know what Africa is about. So we have to build a new set of images that must be associated to Africa. We have two kinds sets of images: the Afro-American paradigm, the American, the British. The French African, those people are still respected. And often we have young African people that want to learn, want to be fluent in English just to be more respected, because the black people are the prototype of the different people. And this clashes with the fact that, as a matter of fact, there are Italian people who are black, and they are totally 100% Italian. They were born here they go to school, they speak fluent Italian, still they're not conceived as Italians. They are not allowed to go to on holidays. They're not allowed to and they have to wait until they turn 18 before being able to leave this country. So this is a system-based racism, which is linked to this issue of power, with this issue of prevalence. Or there was a writer who used to say, "We were not born white. We become white." And this concept of becoming white is at the basis of all this theory on racism. Politics should react to all this. There should be a new form of politics. For in the States, it was unacceptable that young people who were born here are not given the citizenship because of the color of their skin. Once I was in the States and I met white people who were Italians, third or fourth generations Italian citizens, and they not even know a word of the Italian language. So this is what I called systemic racism. And then there is another form of racism. Those that visit Africa and start taking picture of children. But what? Imagine that taking picture of Italian children taken by an African person in Italy. What would the parent say? These are the things that have to be eliminated. These are the signs that Florence was referring to. There are some signs, positive signs. There is a cartoon that I saw the other day, which I liked a lot, of a child that comes back from school, and the father asks, "How many non-Italian are in your class?" And he says, "Dad, in my class there are only kids." Andrew, there are only kids. On this final sentence, if you want, I would like to share with you the following. What it means to be potential ally, what it means to be an anti-racist, because you have clearly described what systemic racism and individual racism is about. But then if you want to share with us your reflections, drawing on direct experience, personal experience, what it means to be anti-racist. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Good morning. And what a privilege to be on this panel with Florence and Kosi. And your stories make me feel very sad, but at the same time also feel a sense of affinity with you, because I think we live in a racist world, we live in a racist society, whether you are in Italy or in South Africa or in Nigeria. I'm Nigerian, living in South Africa. And before I answer your question, you know, on what being an anti-racist might mean, I just want to set a sort of a context. Coming from Nigeria, predominantly black country, very difficult to see white people around. However, you know, building on what Kosi shared, there is structural systemic racism embedded into the consciousness of people. You know, I will not be able to speak to the Italian experience, but the products and the outcomes of histories of colonization and slavery have left the people, in some cases, feeling unworthy themselves. And I think, you know, there's a lot of concept of internalized racism and internalized oppression. And here I mean situations where, you know, as a child, you do something, and instead of people seeing you as a child, people think of you as a white child, and like, wow, you have acted honorably when you do something that is nice and praiseworthy. You have done something, you have acted as a white child, or you're beautiful, and like, oh, you're as beautiful as a white person. And these are the products of years and decades and centuries of oppression and colonization that have left the people, you know, thinking of themselves in this way. So it is not surprising if people in Africa, in Nigeria, can think of themselves in some cases as, you know, think of whiteness as the ideal, think of whiteness as the aspiration, yeah, something to strive, you know, for. Then it would be surprising that people in Italy or in any other parts of the world, perhaps, you know, maybe absurd that people might think that, you know, they live in a racist free society, and I think that doesn't exist. So to answer the question, what an anti-racist effort or interventions might be, I just want to construct this, building on what Florence and Kosi have shared, to share how I think of structural racism, and then, you know, offer my intervention from there. Perhaps, you know, a step back is that, you know, I work for an organization called Rios Partners, and what we do is to help people solve intractable social problems. We help people collaborate on their challenges. And I've been involved with MSF at least for the last 3 years, facilitating the process in Southern Africa called the Dismantling Structural Racism Process. It's been a 3-year process. I don't think, you know, I have time to go into that. But MSF in Southern Africa is saying, you know, we have tried different things, and we have discovered that structural racism is at the heart of our problems, and we want to take efforts to dismantle that. I'm also involved in an international program in MSF, the TIC anti-racism process, where I think there are about 8 co-sponsoring entities that come together to engage in meaningful, courageous conversation, but conversations that are oriented towards action, conversations that are oriented towards awareness and growth. So when I think of structural racism, I think of it as involving at least 3 dimensions. And these 3 dimensions do not need to be satisfied at the same time. The first dimension is what I called the purpose dimension. You know, you look at an organization, you ask the question, what is the purpose of this organization? What has it been set up to do? And what paradigms and ways of being and doing is encouraged and taken as what should be, what should guide how an organization is run? You know, and how is the organization maintaining continuities with the legacies of colonization and slavery and dehumanization paradigms? And I think these sort of paradigms are what's make people, or make black people in many cases, or people that are considered the other, to be threatening, you know, and you think of them as criminals and violent, incompetent, lazy, you know, people in need of help. Because you spoke of how images are used, you know, to portray certain people as people who are always in need of help, cannot help themselves, you know. And essentially, you know, when it comes to a society, they think that these people do not belong. They are less intelligent and therefore can be violated. People can just walk up and touch your hair and you're lacking worth. So, there, you know, if you look at the purpose dimension of structural racism, you know, I think of NGOs that have been set up to further the civilizing mission. You know, colonization in many cases was construed as a civilizing mission. The white people went and you want to civilize the natives and indigenous people. you know, if organizations maintain that continuity, then at the very, at the purpose level of such organization, it is structurally racist. And I would argue that, you know, such organizations should be disbanded and should cease to exist. So that is the first dimension. I will come back to what it means, or maybe I'll come back to what it means to be anti-racist, you know, on this dimension. The second dimension is what I think of as the culture and institutional norms. And here we think of policies and institutional norms that advantage and privilege certain people. And people at the center, in the Italian context, it would be those that are considered Italian and disadvantage those who are not considered Italian. And in an organization like MSF, you look at policies, you know, and ways of being. Sometimes it's unwritten. You know, as someone who has been involved, you know, for some time with MSF, you hear things like, oh, certain people can't wear a particular color of T-shirts. You know, there is a sort of treatment given to those who are international staff, given the history that mostly international staff have been people from the north sent to Africa. And they are thought as those who are doing more meaningful work, those who are making sacrifices. If an African is going to mission, it's not considered the same way. Oh, the African is just doing his job. He wants money. But if a white person is coming to Africa, oh, you're really sacrificing. You know, we should really applaud and be happy that you are leaving your comfort. And it's not construed. It's not understood as, you know, the white person doing his job. And, you know, one person is making sacrifices, the other person is just working. So what institutional norms? It could be embedded in policies, in frameworks, in models that advantage, you know, those who are perceived to be at the center. And it could be the North, white people, Italian, in your context, and disadvantage the other people. And what ways of being and doing are considered the norm and the standard? You know, there was a story shared here in Southern Africa where certain black people and people of color feel like they can't take native, their traditional food into their place of work because people will think, oh, your food smells funny, or, you know, you can't bring this sort of food to the office. So that might be a very, you know, simple example, but it speaks to people that feel like, wow, we really belong here. We feel at home here. And we can express ourselves in all of its dimensions in this organization. And it could be in language. It could be when people gather for social events, what sort of music is played, what are the folk tales and folklores that are told, how do people feel like, you know, they are part of our organization. And, you know, how do people feel a sense of belonging, you know, in the institution that they belong to, feel a feeling of ease, that they can come, you know, with their whole selves and express themselves. So I will stop there. So I've talked about the purpose, the culture, and the norms, institutional norms. The third aspect is what I call the equity representation dimension. Mm-hmm. And in MSF, you know, you could ask the question, how is the spread of leadership? You know, you look at the hierarchy of the organization, you know, even in Southern Africa, that is, most of the population are black people. But you see, in top leadership, it's occupied by white people. Then you ask yourself the question, why? You know, is the leadership sufficiently diverse? And this is the aspect of DEI. DEI often focus on this dimension, the equity representation dimension, forgetting the purpose and the cultural institutional norms dimension. And the question, how are people compensated for their work? Who benefits from the work? You know, it's common to go into offices and those doing menial jobs and cleaner and in the kitchen are black people, and you know, and those who are taken to be doing serious work are, you know, white people. And of course, you know, it calls for various treatments depending or given how work is framed. The intellectual work is taken to be like what is really important, and those doing manual work, you know, are taken to be less than or less intelligent. Of course, you know, these things are intersectional. So along these three dimensions, for me, there is a everyday racism. Florence, I really appreciated, you know, how you took time to share real examples of how the everyday racism manifests. For me, I think I want to complement that by looking at the structural dimension. You know, it's not racism. I think we do not tell a complete story if we just focus on the everyday one. Sometimes the institution can inform. I think there is almost a symbiotic relationship that the individual informs the structural, and the structural informs the individual. So in our intervention, and we do this in the TIC process, we are looking at the individual, trying to enable people to see themselves clearly, but also looking at the structural, what policies and norms should be changed, and how can we build a new organizational culture. So if we look at the purpose dimension, I guess being anti-racist would be to embrace new perspectives and new worldviews and new paradigms, you know, and perhaps, you know, abandon paradigms that are exploitative, that are extractive, that are dehumanizing, you know. And you ask yourself the question, what is our core work? What are we set up to do? You know, it's very common for MSF, in this case, I will use MSF because it's the context, to think of themselves as, okay, we want to go to Africa or, you know, Afghanistan and help people, provide, you know, emergency health. Perhaps there is a new way of thinking about health. You know, how can we heal our society? Is a provocation I want to leave. Can we encompass the meaning of health to healing our society? And maybe MSF has a role to play in the Italian context of enabling conversations and challenging paradigms and challenging worldviews and allowing for alternatives to emerge. And, you know, these alternatives being alternatives that humanize everyone, that humanize particularly those who have been disadvantaged. And here, you know, I might think of the distinction between equality and equity. You know, equality being, let's give everyone, you know, £50. But, you know, equity recognizes the historical barriers and obstacles that people have faced and say, okay, because you have suffered, you know, histories of oppression and histories of dehumanization, we will give you 55 or 60 and recognize, you know, the intersectionalities. So for me, I think at the purpose level is for us to dismantle organizations and institutions that are clearly racist and set up to dehumanize, oppress, exploit, extract people. That is, of course, you know, there is an individual that needs to, you know, act in this way, you know, even at the institutional level. At the cultural, institutional norms, you know, how do we ensure that there is people feel a sense of belonging in the organization? How do we bring people along? How do we ensure that, you know, we decenter those who have been historically centered? We move them away from the center and bring previously marginalized, previously disadvantaged people to the center, and, you know, allow their ways of being, allow their thoughts, allow them to feel like they have a say here, they have power here, we can make decisions in this organization. So that is at the level of institutional norms. And what paradigms and what worldviews shape these norms? You know, in Africa, you know, people talk about people making decisions here from a place of relationality. You know, we feel like we belong. You know, there's a sense of Ubuntu. I am because you are, you know. And I think in the Western paradigm, the individual is central. You know, and here you see people making defenses to things like meritocracy. Oh, you know, if only you can work hard, you can rise and become the president of America like Barack Obama did. And they forget the institutions that have enabled a lot of black people and people of color to be disadvantaged structurally. And at the level of equity and representation is, you know, what images are shown of black people and people of color? How are they paid for their work? How is their work even thought of? You know, the person who is doing menial jobs and cleaning and taking care of our food, is that work considered to be minimal in value than the work of a director? you know, of course, they play a very distinct role. And I think if you think of us, of workers, as involving the functioning of a system, I think the director will not be able to do the work if the office is not clean, and the cleaner will not be able to do the work if things are not running well. And if you take the systems perspective that all the parts are integral to the functioning of this machine, then we will value every part and think of them as really important and compensate people for their work. And are we benefiting from the labor of other people? You know, you call people to do some work for you, and because they do not have the required paper, you exploit them and you pay them less. Or, you know, you refuse to see them. And Florence, what you shared really struck me of that policewoman just touching your hair, not recognizing you, not recognizing your person and your humanity. You know, how are we enabling and allowing these sort of practices, you know, to perpetuate, to continue in our organization? And it's not enough to, for me, I think being an anti-racist is not only about refusing to do these things, refusing to go and touch a black woman's hair and like, wow, it's soft, beautiful. But it's actively working against those practices and paradigms and ways of being. It's speaking up, it's building new systems, it's putting marginalized people at the center, it's redefining, you know, what our place in the world and how we share that place, you know, or share this world with others. So that is, let me leave it there, and I hope I get another chance to maybe elaborate on some of these things.
Grazie mille veramente, Andrew.
Thank you, Andrew. I take this opportunity to thank you personally on behalf also of MSF for the work that we're doing with you on anti-racism within MSF, within our movement. So thank you. We were 15 minutes late when we started, so we're going to take 15 minutes from the coffee break. And so we have time for questions and also thoughts, reflections from the audience. If you have questions for our three panelists, please go ahead. If you want examples or if you want to share your thoughts, this is an incredible opportunity we have. So we're collecting the questions for the panelists. Well, first of all, I would like to thank you for having given us this, for dealing with this issue, which is an endless issue. And I would like to make some similarities. It's wonderful to see Florence and the others. A similarity with MSF when it was set up back in 1971, when we were unprepared, we were unusual, imperfect, bizarre. And even after 51 years, this is still so. Mental health was introduced after 20 years, sexual violence after 30 or 40 years. So we can only improve. We're making progress, we're making headway, so we must not stop in all areas. And this is one area where we need to work. And I think that time is going to help us because many of the things that Florence said pertain to Italy, when speaking about renting places. For instance, in the past in Italy, in Switzerland, years ago, Italians and dogs could not go into shops. They were not admitted to the shops. So we've come a long way from there. So we need to work on these issues. I'm a coordinator, and when there's something that is not clear with regard to the relationship, or when there's an abuse, and even when things are going well, I need to really stop and reflect if things are really okay. So if things are okay with the context and so on. This is an exercise which is difficult. It is very ambitious and refined. And I think that when there are people that work together, automatically we move into the situation where we say, I like this person or I don't, and so on. But at all levels, in the offices, in face-to-face interactions, we need to change our attitude, because uprooting racism is a hard job, and we're still trying not we're trying to make the difference. However, thank you, because this is the right time to consolidate things that I like about MSF, which is that of never stopping, of going ahead, of keeping going. Thank you, Tore. Other thoughts? Like what just Ettore just said about never stopping. I remember the discussions that we used to hold out in the field, the desire to constantly improve, and there's and we're still doing that. Are there any questions for the panelists? Well, I was thinking about the fact that at this point in its history, MSF needs to re-examine its impartiality and neutrality, because I'm thinking of Joe Barons, who raised very important issues with regard to the violation not only of European rights and the Convention on Human Rights, but also international law. So perhaps we need to stop and think and take a stance on racism, and that is a position. So perhaps it's fundamental to face the horizontal governance and of coming into contact and saying, as an NGO, this is our position, or what you're doing is wrong, and therefore interact with civil society on this. Do the panelists want to say something about this? Not perhaps linked to MSF, because you belong to other organizations, but for instance, the debate on recently held on Geo Barons and selective humanitarianism. I don't know whether Cossi or Florence would like to make a comment. Cossi. Well, first of all, the question is, what can we do? Well, first of all, what we can do individually. When we're speaking about general systems, I think that we need to, well, it's not evident, but each of us has prejudice, biases. So we need to work on ourselves individually. So we need to start seeing the other's point of view, especially in the relationship between doctor and patient. In my field, I see this, and as doctors, very often, I see in Italy, the hospitals where I have worked, when a patient comes in, a black person or colored person, they think that the person has unusual diseases. Who knows what disease they may have, and there's no listening. Very often, there's this prejudice, the idea that a colored person, well, they're not supported by their colleagues at work. Very often, the nurses are ill-treated by the patients. and the white colleagues don't defend them. So we need to have the courage to defend our colored colleagues. This at the individual level. And we need to, and speaking about racism may be accompanied by feeling ill at ease. We need to know this. There are many white people are ill at ease when you speak about racism. So it's important when you see that there's an abuse and so on, to show your solidarity, show that you're close to the person who is experiencing the abuse, and recognize the fact that there is an additional stress when we talk about racism, and many people deny it. In the United States, there were Italian teachers at university. They dealt with this issue. They felt ill at ease of recognizing it or seeing Italy considered as an underdog. Well, at the structural level, it's important for there to be greater inclusion of people who experience racism, as you are doing with Andrew, that is adopting policies within the association. This is an important thing. And even the fact that you've invited us to speak about this issue, this is an important opening. I know it's not liked when I say this, but very often on Italian TV, they talk about racism and immigration. But the people who, but the blacks are not absent. So they talk in our stead. They take decisions in our stead. Somebody told me, well, I too, when I walk into a bar with my red hair, they all look at me. And I said, that's not the problem, because you go to the hairdresser and you change the color of your hair. I can't tear off my skin. This is an important thing, which at the structural level, that is at the structural level, your colleague was saying that you need to take a stance. Take a stance. You can't remain in the shadow and then emerge only with, come out with statements, because we have seen this double standard. We have seen that in the concept of solidarity towards migrants and shelters, there's a double standard. We've seen that in Europe welcomes those who have blue eyes, white skin, and blonde hair. They are welcome. This is a fact. I'm not speaking about Africans, but even the Kurds, the Syrians. We've seen how they're treated at the borders. And this is to be reported. It needs to be brought out into the open. And an association can do this, like yours. Well, thank you, Cossi. Any other thoughts you would like to share? Somebody raised their hand.
Think very quickly.
Sure, go ahead.
Thank you. Talking about neutrality and impartiality, I think that those things, neutrality and impartiality, preserves existing power and do not contribute to the shift of power in any system. And earlier I spoke about, you know, what it means to be anti-racist. I think being an anti-racist entails not being partial. It entails some sense of partiality, and you know, abandoning neutrality. We cannot be neutral in making the world a better place. We need to actively shift the power, and this will come with a bit of discomfort or a lot of discomfort, and perhaps you're already feeling that discomfort in your body. The organization will feel it. And if you are feeling that, that is fine. Discomfort is not a bad thing. You know, we say often in our work that we We do not want people to be unsafe, but if you're uncomfortable, that might be a good thing. It might, you know, reveal something about yourself to yourself, or reveal something about the system. And it's common for black people and people of color in this conversation to feel angry. That is also okay. You know, anger is an appropriate feeling for injustice. And we see that oftentimes, you know, people who have power and privilege will say, oh, I don't want to talk to you about this because I don't like your tone. They, you know, want to police people to speak in a particular way that is still maintaining the comfort. If we want to do this work, which I believe that MSF is committed to doing, we at a personal and institutional level need to be comfortable about being uncomfortable.
Thank you very much also for this.
And Florence perhaps wants to say something. Florence, you have the floor. Well, I would like to share some thoughts on anti-racism and what they should do. I think that anti-racists in Italy should accept the idea, and a widespread idea amongst the other Italians, and that is that the anti-racism is linked with ignorance. This can be minimized. Racism and ignorance has nothing to do with ignorance. Racism is a social and cultural system within which people grow and live, and so the people behave in a given way, and they take certain decisions and so on. The racist system in Italy is based on the byword of Italians first. My niece is black, and if she is looking for a house, she calls. They don't know that she's black, but when she goes to the office, they say that the apartment is not available. So we need to be closer to the new generations, the 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds. Give them, listen to them, have them speak. Have them be the spokespersons and protagonists of an anti-racist system in Italy, which must not go through the filters of the white people. But, in my opinion, they should not only leave room to the new generation, make space for them of anti-racists, but understand whether they themselves actually accept or fuel any discrimination and racism unawares through banal gestures or using certain words and through images. I think that this is the first step we should take. Are there any other questions? Well, if there aren't any other questions from the audience, then I would stop make a conclusion, drawing conclusions by thanking the panelists, thanking them for their heartfelt contributions that are deeply felt, as Cossi said, and also Florence and Andrew. You have all spoken about cooperating. Cooperating with white people as potential allies, and looking at the audience and seeing that most of them are white, with a view to wanting to change things in our society. We should consider the examples of everyday racist aspects that Florence told us about. And obviously, it's not an easy situation, and I thank you for having shared these thoughts. So let's recall these examples, and when we see them in action, when we witness them, then let's speak up. Let's try to make people aware of them and therefore deconstruct them. they are part of our society and we need to speak up against them. So I thank you all. I thank the panelists. Let's give them a round of applause to thank them for their contribution.
Ora credo ci sia.
Well, I had some questions, but Silvia told me not to speak. Well, on behalf of the board, this is not the end of it. We're going to continue. Well, we knew this, of course, but after having listened to you, we will follow up on all this. Things are not going to stop here. I thank you all. And all I can say is, wow, we've heard so many reflections, so many thoughts, both individually and as an organization. So let's take a deep breath right now. We have David right now. David is going to share his experience with us. David? David, if that's okay with you. We've changed the program around.
Thank you so much. I know from yesterday to today you are really tired, but when there are intensive things to talk about, we must devote our time and ourselves to understand what is happening and how we can contribute to a better society. From yesterday to today, there are a lot of things. I'm living in a bubble because so many things have been said, interesting facts, which are meaningful for a young and a global citizen like me. And there are things that I would like to debate about, given the time, but unfortunately we are out of time and I have been given a very few minutes to speak. From the beginning of the session, of the event yesterday, we read or we heard a story from Liberia to Sierra Leone. This story struck me very hard to the fact that I thought I was strong for so many years. But it was only a deception because I understood that when you seem to forget where you're coming from, you become weak. The story reminded me of what I had to go through. It has been told by someone and lived by other people. The book has been written by someone, and for us, we lived it as a reality, which means my story cannot be included. I will tell it from a different angle and from a different part of the world. I was born in South Sudan during a civil war in the Sudan. Some of you may not know the history of Sudan, but the people who are here, who have contributed and have volunteered with MSF, don't know exactly what has been happening in Sudan since the last 5 decades. In 1997, I was born in an internally displaced camp. And 2 months later, my family was forced to migrate to Congo. And given the situation in Congo, they couldn't live there. They fled to the Central African Republic, which means I was born in a country where I did not want to choose to be born. Taken to Central African Republic as a child, living in a refugee camp, grew up there with lack of education, with lack of shelter, trying to survive by everyday living and by the mercy of organizations such as UNHCR, MSF, different institutions or community-based system that was able to provide support for the refugees who had come from Sudan. I lived with the traumatized situation until the Comprehensive Peace Agreement was signed in 2005, where a seeming peace was seen in South Sudan between the North and South. Then my family came back home, and then I came home to a society which was supposedly my home, it became new to me. I didn't know the place because I was born and then I was forced to migrate. From the moment I was born, I didn't know anything. I had to start including myself into my own society, to start integrating into my own society, to learn the way of living. This was not enough. We lived in precarious conditions. In 2009, where I wanted to include myself into education, to invest myself into a beautiful society, the war from the neighboring country, the RLA from Uganda, that terrorized the entire part of Congo, South Sudan, and Central Africa, arrived to the place where we were living. This was not a conflict from my own nation. It was an external conflict. After being defeated by the Ugandan government, they started kidnapping young children, killing elderly disabled, using them as child soldiers. And I was one of the people. In 2009, I was taken from my own country, kidnapped by the militias. They were called Lord's Army Resistance, right by Joseph Kony. When I was taken as a child at the age of 12, what choice had I not to be used? What right or what power had I to resist, to say that I don't want to participate in war? I don't want to be part of a bloodshed regime. I was taken to the forest of Congo. We marched. We did every possible and imaginable things. We were given substances. We were forced to kill under command. We were using this Kalashnikov just as we heard yesterday. I had to live with them over a year, going from forest to forest, village to village, and to Central Africa, until in 2010, I was able to escape from them. And then through IOM, I was repatriated back to my country in South Sudan in 2010. I found out that my family had already done a funeral according to the African way, because for a year, nobody ever heard of me. There were no telecommunications that I could use to reach them. Once again, I was neglected. I was robbed of my fundamental human right as a child to grow up in a peaceful circumstance, to provide, to educate and nourish myself. This did not stop me. I still wanted to acquire more education. And at that point where we felt that my country got its independence in 2011, and there was a seeming peace, there was time for us to reconcile, to build a better nation. Just 2 years later, South Sudan went into another civil war, and today, as I speak, it has killed more than 400,000 people and displaced about 2 million. And among the people who have been displaced or who have been forced to take into exile, I am one of those today. But my decision to go into exile did not come as a weak point, because at the same time when war started in my country, my government and the rebel group were forcibly conscripting young children. As young as I was, with the experience that I was forcibly conscripted by the RLA, and now I was facing the same thing from my government. They forcibly conscripted me. I had to fight again, because in a society where I came, for you to live, for you to survive, you must take another life. This was too heavy for me. I lived with it for a year and two, and I wanted to denounce it. I had to flee. I had to go to school to mobilize high school student, to tell them that it is not right to kill our own people. It is not right to participate in a war when you're 16. It is not right to kill your own people when we don't have anything in common but a beautiful nation to contribute to. That was when the government started to persecute me. My family was traced, and they were forced into exile once again to Uganda, to Congo, and to Central Africa. To this day, they still live in Uganda. The people who were included in the high school movement, they were killed and they disappeared under mysterious circumstances to this day. I had to denounce this for so many years until I reached at the age of 18, knowing that I could now be held accountable for my actions, knowing that for me to decide to kill, it means that I am becoming an evil citizen, meaning that I was choosing a way to rebel against the entire world. So I decided to become a refugee. I left my country with nothing. I left my country knowing that there was a misconception waiting me that when you become a refugee, you are nobody, you are a weak person, you are a person to be always in need, to live at the mercy of others, to live at the mercy of a host community, to live at the mercy of international organization. I knew all this. I knew that I was leaving my society where I grew up. I was leaving my school colleagues with whom we had ideas, with whom we had simple dreams and ambition to exist in a peaceful circumstance. I knew that I would never see my family, not in the sooner, in the nearest future. I looked at all this and I decided to become a refugee, to question, to look for a man, to look for a nation that can convince me that I don't have the right to exist, not even entitled to a social standard of life, not even education of quality. Before leaving, I tried to ask for visas to enter safe countries in America, in the West, so I could proceed with my education. But I was neglected, which is a topic to talk about, the visa restriction to the people in the Global South. But today, I cannot elaborate on it. So many people, so many speakers from yesterday and today have spoken about these things. I fled to the Northern Sudan only to be refused. They said, my name is David and I'm coming from South, which means I was a Christian. There were religious indifferences which led to the division of Sudan. So I couldn't find refuge or shelter in Sudan. I proceeded to the Republic of Chad where I was given asylum. I was given a seeming protection. But looking at the situation in Chad, Chad is one of the poorest countries in Africa, and yet it is hosting more than 6 million refugees, and it's not complaining like what we see today in Italy, with hundreds of people arriving on the Mediterranean, and it is being called a state of emergency, with millions fleeing from Ukraine and being welcomed. All these things, these are things we should reflect on and question, why does this have to happen? When I arrived in Chad, and I was under security, but the sense of not being able to educate and nourish myself, given the poor living condition in the country, it led me to question the human nature of migration, the rights that I had to migrate, the rights that I had since birth, that I have the right to migrate to Europe, to America, because I found myself as a global citizen. I found myself not only belonging to South Sudan, I found myself with the will to migrate to country, to look for the things that I wanted. I was also looking at the push factors of migration. I was one of the victims being pushed to migrate, because push factors means that there was war in my country of origin, and then I'm forced to migrate. It means that there is poverty, there is climate change, I'm facing persecution from my government or from political institutions that I had to flee. But when we look at the push factors, we find that in Europe today, in Italy, people migrate to America, to Europe, across European countries for educational purposes, for well-paid jobs in Germany. These are things, these are natural causes. These are natural, fundamental nature of human beings to migrate for different reasons. But for us, for refugees, we are none of these and we have been criminalized. In Chad, there was nothing I could do to survive. So I fled to Libya with the intention to work in Libya, because Libya, for us, it's a rich country, regardless of its political crisis. But when I arrived in Libya, I arrived only to a nightmare made of torture, extortions, forced labor, forced conscription, and inhuman arbitrary detention system, which is fully funded by the European and Italian government to this day. When I arrived to the common people, I was an immigrant. I was someone looking for a safe place. To the smugglers, I was a banknote, which he wanted to multiply to make money out of. To the traffickers, I was a subject that he wanted to sell, that he wanted to make use of. To the government, I was someone to be seen as a human shield, as a shield during war times. And to the European society, to the Italian government, I was an instrument to be used as a political bargain, to have a political interest in Libya and in the Maghrebi region. When I say I am, it means I'm talking about thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people in the Sahel, in West Africa, in East and Middle East countries who come to Libya to work, but as a result of a memorandum signed between European State and Libya, we are none of these and we cannot breathe. When I couldn't find peace in Libya, I tried to take on the Mediterranean with the dingy boats. There are those of you here who know the story of the Mediterranean, how people are drowning on the Mediterranean, how Mediterranean has become the graveyard, but yet we don't question why is this happening? Why are the people forced to take on dingy boat and come to Europe? Do they come by their choice? Or there are reasons that forces us to come without looking back? Or there are things that puts us in a point of no return, that we just want to see the other side of the world, that we just want to exist in a peaceful circumstance. When I took on the Mediterranean in 2019, I was pushed back by the Italian Coast Guard. I was sent to Libya, where I was arbitrarily detained for a period of 7 months in inhuman condition, forced to work in constructions, in farms of the Libyan militias, Libyan mafia paid by Italian. When I survived that, I tried again because I couldn't live in Libya, because I was only seen as an easy source of income. I was seen as a source of economy, both to the Italian government and to the Libyan militia men. I tried for the second time to cross the Mediterranean, only to be pushed back to Libya, to the same scenario which I had to live in. I tried for the third time, to the same thing. The fourth time I tried in 2020, in the period where there was war in Libya, I was sent to the detention center. I was then sold by the traffickers to the Libyan government, where I was forcibly conscripted again. The same scenario which I had lived in 2009, in 2013 in my country, and in 2016, which I had decided to leave my country, I found myself in the same thing in Libya. I was sent to war front using howitzers, different weapons that I had to use, because I was subdued, everything under gunpoint. With my will to exist, I had to abide. I had to obey because I wanted to live. I wanted to make sure that I can survive and tell this story and stand in the face of injustice in the nearest future. So I had to do everything possible to survive. I lived with this. I had to fight in a country which is not mine. I had to fight under a system funded by Europe. I had to fight using a weapon made in Italy, made in Russia, made in America. All this I was questioning and documenting it with my scars. There were no means to document it with the modern technology. But for us, the people in Libya, we have documented this with our blood, with our scars, with our memories, with our traumatized way of living. It was not enough. Our bodies, our power, our wills, our ideas have been controlled by this mechanism, a mechanism that have been drawn by Europe to kill without a touch. We have called this memorandum between Italy and Libya an act of terrorism because it has killed someone coming from Syria who wanted to have peace in Libya, someone fleeing from the war in Afghanistan, someone fleeing from the Al-Shabaab regime in Somalia, the war, the genocide in Darfur, the climate change, the poverty in the Sahel, in West African countries, arriving to Libya only to see this mechanism drawn to kill. Mediterranean is not the only graveyard today. The Libyan concentration camps have become a graveyard. The Sahel have become a graveyard for us, for the people who just want to exist, for the people who do not know politics, for the people who, if given the chance, could build a more political arena that could include a global society. But we are none of this. This did not stop me from doing something. After I knew that my life was going to be meaningless until it is taken, I decided, and I was thinking in a way to contribute in Libya. I knew it was going to take my life, or the life of those that were living next to me, or the life of those who wanted to be part of the change. Last year, in October, in a neighborhood in Tripoli, called west of Tripoli, called Grigarish, it was a makeshift and a home to more than 10,000 refugees, asylum seekers, and immigrants. The name I'm using, these are words given to us by people. For us, we do not want to be called refugees. We do not want to be called immigrants. We do not want to be called asylum seekers. We want to be called humans. Because it's not about the number. It's about individuals. It's about a mother trying to survive, trying to give a bread to her child, trying to build a peaceful circumstance for her children. It's about a young man trying to survive, trying to work on his own, trying to do something for himself by himself, but has refugees, has the names given to us, asylum, refugees. We are none of these. We are seen as people who lack potentials to act on our own, to build and nourish ourselves. We are meant to stay in concentration camp, in refugee camp, where we wait and survive at the mercy of international NGOs. When our neighborhood was attacked, more than 5,000 children, women, elderly, disabled were taken to the Libyan concentration camp. And many more lost their properties. And I was among the people who fled. But to my surprise, nothing was on the media, not even the international community, not even the international NGOs like UNHCR was denouncing this ill treatment against people, against refugees who had the right to stay in Libya. And the UNHCR, whose mandate, whose responsibility was to protect the people under its mandate in Libya. And Libya has a nation which has the right and a fully responsibility to protect the people and respect their fundamental human rights under its territory, regardless of their race, regardless of their identity, regardless of their countries of origin. All these things were undermined, and we became a sense of mockery to the Libyan national. Naked pictures of our women being shot at, being raped, were played over the national television of the Libyan society. And I couldn't be able to withstand this. I was not ready to take this. I went to the UNHCR headquarters in Tripoli and knocked on their door that, look at what is happening to the people under your mandate. Look at what is happening. We need protection. But we were turned away. They told us they had limited mandate in Libya and they could not do something. So the second part of my story is that here. There is a short video explaining how we lived in Libya.
Un attimino, c'è un discorso logistico, mi pare di capire. Due minutini.
Follows a crackdown by Libyan security services earlier. This month in the town of Girgarish, where at least 5,000 migrants are. They're hungry and thirsty, and they've been sleeping on the dirt. People give them water as they pass by the crowd of migrants. They've been here for days, some for more than a week. They're hungry and thirsty, and they've been sleeping on the dirt. People give them water as they pass by the crowd of migrants outside this UN facility in Tripoli. They each have a story to tell. Mohammed Dawood says he escaped from the Mabani detention center on Friday, and has been here ever since.
So we are homeless. We have no place to go. The UN is the responsibility. It
dobbiamo risolvere, se non è un problema tecnico lo, okay, lo mettiamo alla fine.
Ma è alla fine. Posso provare con l'altro? I don't know if the result will be better, but I'll try.
Scusate, perché online non gira. Facciamo un altro tentativo e poi altrimenti continuiamo con.
We're going to make another attempt, and if it doesn't work, we'll continue with our program.
It's okay.
I'm sorry.
Your battery is low.
I'm sorry, David.
Can you go to the slides?
Yeah, sure.
Perché un video online un link e non gira.
Vabbè, fa niente, andiamo direttamente alle slide.
Ci sono delle slide, diceva.
Di David, hai delle slide? Do you have slides? Ok, yeah.
Sì, sì, prendi il mio. Your mic.
Ok.
Ok.
Beh, il video, ci sono stati dei problemi.
So we had problems with the video, but there are some slides that we'd like to share with you.
I'm really sorry. We try to give you a short video about the situation of the refugees in Libya, what happened after the attack on the neighborhood. As I mentioned, that on that day, last year in October, we lost thousands of people to this inhuman treatment, and we went direct to the UNHCR headquarters to ask to be recognized, to ask for evacuation out of the country if Libya did not want us, if Italy continued to push us away from its border. But we were not listened to, as it has happened for so many years, that we are people who have been deliberately silenced, but not anymore, because when we arrived at the UNHCR headquarters, the only thing we understood was that we had to start organizing ourselves. We had to speak for ourselves, because we looked at the situation and we saw that journalists, different human rights groups, institutions have traveled to Libya and documented all this dehumanized treatment. But most of the stories told to the international community have been filtered. And it was not told in the right way that it should have been told. So we understood organizing ourselves was necessary to give a voice to ourselves. We started, we set a permanent garrison in front of the UNHCR headquarters in Tripoli, and it consisted of more than 3,000 people for 3 months and 10 days. We slept in the street, and before we did that, on the ground, we were people with nothing in our hands. We were people who were attacked, and we lost everything that we had available at our disposal. Doing a protest in Libya, in a country where if you have to protest, you must have armored tanks, you must have heavy weapons. We knew that we were going to be killed, we were going to be shot at, and it happened, but we were ready to die for a cause greater than ourselves, for a cause greater than the situation that we had to live in. Because we wanted to give and to shed light to our plights. We wanted to reach the international community and question the institutions that have undermined our existence. In Libya, it was not enough. So we thought of a way to reach the international community. If there were no televisions, there were no journalists allowed by the Libyan government to come to the site where we were protesting, because they wanted to continuously silence us. We only had mobile cell phones, where we formed a movement, Refugees in Libya. From the ground, we tried to visualize it. We tried to make it a social movement for the people, for the international community, to be able to reach us. We had nothing. We had no bread. We had cell phones, very few of us. So we created the first movement on Twitter, because we understood that it was the only necessary way to reach the politicians and the international community. It consisted of more than 11 nationalities, bringing ourselves together. 3,000 people who had devoted themselves to stay in the street, to demand the authorities, to demand the international community for their rights to be protected and respected, to live in dignity in Libya, and to have the right for migration, to have the right to access European countries, as do the other people. So this movement, Refugees in Libya, did not end there. Go. Twitter was not enough. What we did as self-organized people was create a website where we could document, where we could write articles while in the street, where we could write testimonies of people who have been shot at with live bullets and show it to the international community. We created a website under the name Refugees in Libya. We tried to shed light on our plights. We knocked on the door of the international community. Only Pope Francis was the first person to recognize us, to share his closeness to our situation, and then followed by few interested civil organizations and sea rescue organizations in Italy and across Europe. MSF was there, Mediterranean Saving Humans, Sea Watch, and other civil realities. But this was not enough, because the European institutions didn't want us to have a voice. The Libyan government and the Libyan mafias wanted us to be silent about this. We continue to protest. We continue to demand. We had to set our political manifesto to call for our rights to be protected, to call on the UNHCR not to stand neutral when this disaster befalls us, and to call on the UNHCR to remind them that we are people under its mandate in Libya, with asylum document, with refugee status, and their responsibility was to protect us, and to call on the Libyan state to look at us as human beings, to call on the Libyan state to close all the concentration camps in Libya, the detention system, which is funded by Europe, and to bring the perpetrators before justice. Because since the memorandum was signed in 2017, more than 25,000 people have died on the Mediterranean, and many more unrecorded deaths have happened in the Libyan concentration camps. And unimaginable data, which I cannot tell, which happens in the Sahel when people try to reach Libya, how people are shot and buried in the desert. These are things which are not documented. These are things which people have recorded with their eyes and with their scars. We tried to amplify our voices, but it was not enough. After 3 months, living in the street without food, without water, this was the situation. We lived here, we slept in the street, as the people, and there were a few interested institutions to come and help us give a voice to ourselves, because we didn't need help. What we needed was a respect and a protection to our fundamental human right, because we were not weak. We are young men, we are young people who are able to do something for ourselves. but given the hindrance, given the restriction, given the political limbo which we are put in, we are none of these. We could not breathe and we could not do anything for ourselves. Just as I was mentioning, this is the situation which we wrote to the international community. We were explaining who we are, the refugees who came from where, from South Sudan, Sierra Leone, and all the countries that have been at civil war for so many years, and the Sahel region, which is fighting against climate change, which is fighting against droughts, against poverty, arriving to Libya with the intention to work, and people seeking a second chance for their life, which they have the right to. In Europe, but they were neglected and pushed away, as you have seen. It was not enough even. The extortion, the tortures, was not enough for the Libyan authorities. They wanted a full control over our body, the body of our women, to be used as sex slaves, young men to be used in war fronts, to be used as war shields. Many more happened until last year. It's a long thread. I cannot go through it. I have to conclude. Until this year, in January, the authorities, the same militias who have constantly attacked us, came again and dismantled our protest violently. Hundreds of people, thousands of them, who were protesting together with me, were taken to concentration camp called Enzara. And this detention center is officially funded by the Italian government. To this day, I speak. More than 300 of them are still kept there since January. In the period where we had protested in the street, if you could go a little more further, we were shot at. The Libyan government constantly came and shot at us. They shot at our young men, our women, because they wanted us to be silent. They passed us by with the hatred that have been manipulated into their mindset by the Libyan authority and by the European authorities, that we are just substances, that we are not people, went deeper into the hearts of the Libyans, that they reached at the extent of knocking down people with their cars while passing in the street, because we were living and surviving in the sidewalk of Tripoli. We lost dozens of lives, but still we were dedicated. We were devoted to bring a voice to ourselves. After it was dismantled, we went into diverse locations. Still, we continued to do something for ourselves. Remotely, we used our mobile phones to do what was necessary. Still, this was not enough. After being shot at, me personally, being regarded as the person who organized the protest, the Libyan mafia and militias started looking for me, and they shot at me several times. The place where I was living was attacked. My roommates were shot at and they died there. But I knew that my life was longer than this because I survived 3 assassination attempts in Libya, leaving my friends dead, and I had to constantly go into the hidings. It was at that moment where I asked the Italian authority for a humanitarian visa to enter Italy legally. But I was rejected. I was neglected by the same institution which is funding the dehumanized situation that we had to go through in Libya. My case fatherly was taken by volunteered lawyers who wanted to make sure that I have a voice. It was taken to Rome Tribunal Court. Again, it was rejected. I had to take on the rubber dinghy boat again for the 5 times to cross the Mediterranean. This time, I can say I was lucky. In June this year, at the end, I crossed the Mediterranean all on my own, knowing that it was a suicide mission, knowing that I could get drowned on the Mediterranean as it has happened in the previous journeys, knowing that I could get pushed back to Libya, and then it could be the end of me. When I crossed the Mediterranean, it was not the end. We have heard about the racism that people of color are facing in Italy. It was not the end, because I still had people who lived with me in this pain, who shared their thoughts with me. I could imagine faces, individuals whose will was to exist. A child who wanted to go to school and become a doctor and become whoever you are in these rooms. Are you a doctor, a teacher, an entrepreneur? I saw all these potentials in the people that I lived with in Libya, so I didn't want to be silent. I was also looking at the solidarity that have been shown to the people, to our brothers in Ukraine. While we were in Libya for so many years trying to be recognized, we did not condemn this act of solidarity. We did not call it a racist solidarity, as it has been said by other people. We found it something necessary, because as refugees, every loss of life is a tragedy to us. And when there are people ready to welcome and help save lives, it becomes a better society. For us, we only understood that this solidarity came massively in the sense that the nature of human is to perceive what is closer to his place. Ukraine is just at the border of Italy and other European cities. Well, in Africa, where civil wars have been happening, it has not been portrayed on the newspaper, on television channels, as it is. The lack of journalism, the lack of storytelling, the lack of live broadcasting like what we see in Ukraine is what brought the lack of global solidarity to the people in Africa. That is what we understood. Because if you are living in a circumstance where your neighbor has lost his daughter, you may feel the pain. Not until you lose your own daughter in your own compound, and then you feel it. This is what is happening in Ukraine, and the European society are trying to do what is best they can. It is the same situation the people in Chad felt, that they have been able to welcome more than 6 million refugees. It is the same situation that people in Uganda felt, and they have received millions of refugees from all the neighboring country, and they do not complain like what is happening today in Italy against the people coming from the other southern part of Mediterranean. This system, with our movement, with the refugees in Libya movement, we have formed a solidarity network bringing together the civil society in Europe, starting from Spain, from France, Italy, Germany, Switzerland, London, the Netherlands, Brussels, because it is the only way to share the light on what is happening beyond the Mediterranean, on what influence the politics, the policy making has on immigration, on how migration is being criminalized, not to everybody, but to a certain society, a mechanism drawn in a sense of political bottle. But in this mechanism, it is we, the people, who are paying the price. It is we, the people, who have been put on the forefront to lose our life, to lose our children, to lose our dreams. We have been usurped of our fundamental human right, and it is being used for politics. But for us, we still believe that there is a better politics, which can include everybody. So many of you in this room are wondering, and I know so many of you are already great contributors, great volunteers who have tried to do something in your respective organizations, as individuals, but don't we question, is this not enough? If MSF have been existing for 50 years, how long more can it exist? How long more can they cure the people who have been wounded? And how are these people being wounded? Can we not look at Africa? If we are condemning, if we are criminalizing migration and refusing the people who need to be protected, who need to be recognized, do we not look at the situation which is forcing them to migrate? Do we not question from where do we have these weapons? We look at Africa. I have been questioning since when I was 12, since I was sent to war front at the age of 12, using a Kalashnikov, using a grenade made in Italy, made in Russia. And in Africa, we don't produce not even a bullet. Today, we look at Africa, we only see 5 countries out of 54 different nations. Out of 54 countries like Italy, bigger more than that. 5 countries that is able to produce weapons. We look at South Africa. We look at Ethiopia, which started producing weapons in the 1800s. And the idea was to stand the face of oppression, to avoid invasion of their country. And it was their right to denounce it in this way. We look at Egypt, which started to produce weapons, not until the 1900s, also against the invasion. But in all the rest of the 50 countries in Africa, we only see in the streets Kalashnikov, we see militias, we see armored tanks, not made in Africa, but given to Africa to kill ourselves. Political approach that is to divide the ethnic groups within a society, that is able to split people apart. Do we not question if we want to build a beautiful society? Why don't we create a global space which is ready to denounce, which is ready to question our authorities against the mass production of advanced weapons, of nuclears? We have seen what is happening in Ukraine. People are living at the mercy of Putin because there is a nuclear weapon, because we were sleeping. The society, the entire society in Africa, in Europe, in Asia, in America, the common people like you are the government, but we do not acknowledge these facts. We elect our people, into the parliament, into governmental institutions, and we let them free to act, to take decisions on our behalf, and we don't question if these decisions is affecting today or tomorrow our future. If these decisions, if this mass production of weapons, of mass destructions, is going to affect our climate, our global world, our global shelter, we have to question all this, and we should be able to denounce all this system. If we want Africa to be at peace, if we want Africa to stop coming to Italy, to European countries, we need to stop in the face of those who are giving weapons to the people. No one can fight, no one can kill to the extent of 400,000 people in South Sudan without the use of weapon. So these weapons are destructive, and we say no to these things. Nobody in the Middle East could be able to bomb the Syrian society without the use of these heavy weapons made in Russia, made in other European countries. We have to question this. We have to question the sense of our solidarity. That solidarity means that we are excluding a society and then extending more of our hands to a certain society of our race. Do we not question human nature of a value? Do we not look beyond our borders? Do we not question our politicians, what they are doing on our names, what they are doing at our borders, what is happening beyond the borders? We have to question all this, and there is so much that we can do. Thank you.
Are there questions, remarks, comments, reactions? There's a question.
Very much, David, for having the courage and the confidence, looking at the pathway that you have moved so far since you were born. The challenges you've gone through, And I think everybody here would acknowledge that you are a hero in all these. I have two specific questions, and the first one is, you struggled so much to get into Italy, and or to get into the West, the America, and so forth, but you could not make it, and many attempts you are being forced backwards, and you have put most of the blame to the Italian government, having the concentration centers and sponsoring them and ensuring that refugees are not allowed to move across the Mediterranean Sea. You are now in Italy. How do you feel being here? Do you see, and as you continue giving these conversations, do you feel secure? Do you feel like you'll be profiled by the Italian government, for example? Do you see the same still going on against you as you are here? I know it's not been that long, few months that you've been here, but how do you feel as you relate to Italians, the Italian government, the population here? And relating back to the story that Florence took us through, the racism, what is the thin line between those frustrations and the racism aspect? The second question is, you've spoken so much about UHCR, but you spoke little about MSF. And of course you said MSF really tried to do a lot in terms of providing shelter, providing support at the Mediterranean Sea. But apart from that, what do you think would be the failures of MSF? How can we do better going forward? Just apart from the treatment, the support, how can we increase the voice against the frustrations that human beings like you, and I don't want to use the terminologies, refugees and asylums and so forth, how do you see MSF participating in changing all these? Thanks.
Thank you. To answer your first question, I think my arrival to Italy, and to my own understanding, I will define it in two ways. The first thing, if I'm to feel safe, I will do so knowing that I am a global citizen, knowing that I have the right to live and work and exist wherever I want to be. In this context, I feel safe in Italy. But as a person of color, as a person being termed immigrant from South Sudan, I don't feel safe. As a person with this lived experience that I had to endure for so many years in Libya, and with the existing and continuous ill treatment against the people who are still in Libya, and people even after arriving at the shores of Italian waters, are being selected to disembark and who not to disembark, I cannot feel safe. I look at the Italian government and I tell them I don't feel safe in Italy. If you cannot protect me, if you are still killing people of the same situation that I was in Libya and on the Mediterranean. When I arrived, I never felt safe, and I'm not going to feel safe until this agreement, this deadly memorandum between Libya and Italy and Egypt, which is now extending its way and all the way to the Maghreb region in Morocco, are dismantled and are not used continuously in this way. And if we can create a different mechanism, it could be a safe passage for migration as whole. This is the answer to your question, to the first one. And the second one, I would look at MSF. I think I already answered your question when I was speaking, that MSF have been existing for more than 50 years. But how do they see themselves if they choose to be natural? In war countries, they stand there not going to march into the government, not going to march into the rebel system because they want to help. They want to heal the people. The people who are wounded in war fronts and who need different medical support, they want to have connections they want to have ties with all these parties. It's starting to be natural, not to be ready to denounce all the system, not to be ready to stand in the face of government or the rebel groups to tell them that it is not right to carry a weapon and to shoot at someone. So in this way, we think MSF have failed, and we need them to advance the way of commitment, the way of communication, the way of approach to include into politics. Today, everything is politics. I have understood that people are always afraid of politics, but in our daily life, we all live in political ways. With our families, with our children, we live politically. In our household, there is politics. We plan how to do things. This is the way how politics is being done. But at the governmental level, it is done in an evil way, which is designed to kill, which means we have to include ourselves as institutions, as individuals. We must participate in the decision-making. We must document. We know that MSF have documented so many things, so many scenarios around the world, so many testimonies of this chaotic situation, of scenes of destruction that people had to go through. But how are they using it? Who are they submitting it to? Are they trying to reach just the commoners in order to receive funds to continue doing their work? Or they are trying to confront the authorities to tell them, look at what is happening. This is happening because of you, because of the policies that you do on the paper, because of the political influence that you have on a society that is raising them to fight against each other. Do they confront the rebels in each country, the authoritarian system, and tell them that this is not right? So I think we should reflect more on this. As MSF, as individuals, as volunteers, this could be my simplest answer to your question. Thank you.
I think that there is a lot of food for thought, and we will certainly have to continue discussing this topic. I think there is time for one more question. Just to say that this is not the end of it. We will certainly follow on this debate. Mine is not a question, but a remark. I'm proud of being part of MSF, and I want to reiterate that what we said this morning is that we want to be anti-racist, but also we want to be the opposite of racist, because our duty lies in the fact of making choices. I go to schools, and I immediately tell the students that I'm not neutral. Being neutral is not a value. This can be result in lack of justice. So, having seen the governments of Greece, Malta, and Italy have defined as lawless, unlawful NGOs, well, this makes us very proud because we are sitting in the right place. As someone else said, we are proud of the place we are. Thank you. I'm sorry, but one final reflection. Paolo from Bologna. We are talking of being neutral, being unbiased, which are the guiding principles of MSF. That defines the mission, MSF mission. When it comes to neutrality and unbiased approach, when we deal with medical mission, this is the mission of Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders. Please do not get me wrong. In the civil society, in the evaluation of all these trends, of course, we have to be neutral. But do not forget that the mission of Doctors Without Borders is ruled by these principles. This is my own personal view, and if I'm wrong, I have to review all the mission. Thank you. Thank you. Are there other people that want to? Nope. Okay. As I said, I want to repeat, this is not the end of it. They're not going to stop here.
Questions, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Grazie. Stay with us for lunch. Chiamo Wanda.
Just one thing.
Yeah, sorry.
Just a little thing for those who are here in Italy and other European countries. On the 9th and 10th of December, we are planning a sit-in, a symbolic sit-in in Geneva at the UNHCR headquarters.
Wow.
And it's being organized by so many civil societies in Europe and has a solidarity with the refugees in Libya movement. So if you are interested, you can check it online. There is so much to contribute. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you. That's your water.
Thank you.
Okay, grazie, Daniel. Okay, lascia la parola a Wanda.
And now I give the floor to Wanda, who will pay tribute to a friend whom I had not the fortune of meeting. And Wanda will tell us more about Rosalba. For those of you who do not know me, I'm a volunteer from the Milan-based group. I have to pay tribute to Rosalba Sferzi, a volunteer, coordinator of the volunteers group of Padua, one of the very first pioneers of the voluntary movement, together with Giovanni from Verona. In 2003, they agreed to the need to to start launching a grassroots campaign in terms of voluntary work. And in doing so, they managed to raise the awareness of the local communities. And our role as in that regard was particularly successful. When she stepped into the Médecins Sans Frontières in 2005, she was the coordinator of the Padua group. Later on, as part of the movement and as part of the association, grew bigger and bigger. She sit on the board from 2011 to 2018, when Loris De Filippi was president. I am a coordinator of the Milan group since, I've been the coordinator of the Milan group since 2013. In 2012, the Milan group experienced something quite special. We question ourselves, we question our work, we changed the coordinator, we wanted to renew our leadership. We spent nights on and discussing. There was Rosalba, Giovanni, Marco from Genoa. They were very supportive. They were encouraging us to keep working. So I'm pleased and happy to pay tribute to Rosalba. She was a true activist and a volunteer who was inclined to share ideas without being afraid of disagreeing with others, always trying to being loyal to her principles. She wrote a letter when submitting her candidature to the IB. She went to Mozambique in 1998. She was there for on business, and She became enthused with the work done by MSF, and later on she became an activist, and take the opportunity to thank all the activists that are here. So just to celebrate the commitment of all the activists and all the volunteers, I would like to ask you to give her a symbolic round of applause. And I call on this podium her husband, who would like to share with us some thoughts.
Grazie, Wanda.
Thank you, Wanda. I just want to share a couple of reflections. There is one thing that was fully shared by Rosalba, integrity. Integrity. Rosalba was a totally responsible person with herself and with all the things that she did. And indirectly, I have become familiar with MSF through the actions undertaken by herself on behalf of MSF. And I totally respect the integrity and the rigor that can be perceived in the work done by MSF, notwithstanding the complexity of MSF structure. And often I thought it was a little bit too rigid. And when discussing this with Rosalba, she was always supporting, standing by MSF.
Grazie, grazie anche per questo ulteriore.
Thank you for your thoughts. Now we have a 10 minutes break. The next workshop will be only with people in presence, and this will be include the presentation made by Tamara, and so there will be no remote participation, and so up until now we had this approach of working with people remotely, but that's the end of it. We will, after the break, after this 10 minutes break, we will meet again 12:40 on time, sharp, please.
Parlo? Si sente? Si sente benissimo. Ok. Io poi avrò bisogno di venire su e giù. Posso salire anche da qua o... Ah, ok, perfetto. Perfetto. Sì. Si sente bene, direi. E si sente anche in questa direzione. Perfetto. Lascerei due o tre sedie che se c'è qualcuno che si vuol sedere, si può sedere. In modo che c'è questa... No, 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 è che se qualcuno vuol sedersi ha la possibilità di sedersi. No, bastano due o tre, tanto... Sì, un paio per lato, tanto. Sì, sì, sì.
Vieni a far parte del giro di licenza di dall'esecutivo, entra per entrare nel direttivo. Sto confondendo il filo esecutivo, tieni, rientra nel direttivo. Qui nessuno vuole prestiamo caro.
Dov'è Annalisa?
Licenza di entra nel direttivo. Aspetta, vediamo. Licenziatevi volontari, entrare nel direttivo.
Sono qui. Ah, si è sentita. No, cioè, io farei rientrare.
Sì, sì.
No, e poi...
Grazie per l'ammissibilità.
Ah, no, tranquilla. Che altro magari chiedere, cioè io quello che chiederei è se possiamo andare un po'.
perché adesso è meno 20 all'una,
sì.
Se facciamo fino all'una e mezza veramente
facciamo
niente, no, cioè, se si può andare avanti almeno fino a un quarto alle due, cioè.
Sì, sì.
Però è da capire, cioè,
sì.